Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello, this is Alejandro Rojas, your host for UFO Think Tank Radio, and I just realized something. I lied to you all. And you know what? I don't care. Deal, people. No, just kidding. I'm not much of a liar. I have this thing where I do not like to lie, and I don't do it very well because it's like, why? Why? Let's live in reality, people. Anyways, it's more like I spaced something out, which isn't too bad. This is all about space, right? And that was to make some news music. I was going to make some news music. I told you guys I was going to do some music like CBS, like da-da-da-da, you know, or something, and I didn't do that. And I apologize, and I'll try to do that for next week. It's just that this week has been so busy. In fact, I wasn't planning on doing a show tonight because I just had so much to do. But anyway, I did do one, and I'm so happy because I've got a great interview tonight, and that is with Tracy Austin, a very lovely woman from who comes from England, and now she lives in Las Vegas. And so, going from this, you know, lovely slopes with lovely English people, drinking tea and having a good time, to crazy Las Vegas in the middle of the desert. We've actually had her on the show before, and we've talked about all her personal experiences. She shared that with us before. However, what we're going to talk about tonight is pretty cool. It's this brand new book that she has put together on UFO sightings in the Western United States. So mostly California, I think Utah and New Mexico or something like that. She'll tell us in a little bit here, but you know, the Western states. So she's written about 9 cases in particular, mostly doing with abduction, alien abduction. Dun, dun, dun. Some kind of scary music there, because that's mostly scary. Because people, you know, in the middle of the night saying they're being taken and weird stuff done to them. And, oh, my goodness. And it's, of course, very hard for people to understand or even believe that, you know, people are being taken in the middle of the night. It's like, come on, right? But, you know, a lot of people believe this to be happening to them. And it's interesting that they have similar stories, and more so, a lot of researchers have looked into it and feel it. There seems to be some sort. Don't freak out. But some sort of like hybridization program going on. Okay, settle down. Don't freak out. I told you not to freak out. So yeah, is that what's happening there? I don't know. So we're gonna talk to Tracy about that, and this is gonna be a lot of fun. Otherwise, things going on in the news. Da, 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 da. So I talked a little bit about this. There's been some news regarding Gary McKinnon. Gary McKinnon, of course, was the man who hacked into government computers at several locations to look for ET information. He did find some. He does. And people get mad at me, but I'm sorry. These are his words. He said he was stoned and drunk much of the time. And that's not to say anything bad about him. He did this 10 years ago. I'm older than him, but I would say about 20 years ago, I was drunk and stoned myself. So I'm not saying that's bad. I'm saying we all get drunk and stoned during our 20s, don't we? Hands, a couple of them. Well, at least I did a lot, you know, in my early 20s. I apologize if that offends you, but I'm through it now. I am clean. I found meditation, and I don't want anything screwing with my inner groove because I got a good groove going on here. So I don't touch that stuff anymore, but Gary did, and, you know, then he hacked into these computers. And he was inspired by Stephen Grin, the Disclosure Project. And he says he found some stuff, some like a roster of non-terrestrial humans. And he saw a picture of a UFO, he says. But unfortunately, he did not save any of this evidence. So it's all hearsay on his part. Regardless, he really did hack into computers. He was then arrested. He was given the option, hey, you would fess up to this, we'll throw you in jail for a few years. He said he gave the U.S. The middle finger, and they said, okay, we're throwing the book at you. And now that he doesn't want to be extradited. And I don't blame him. I talked about this before, about how the English and really fear American prisons because they see it on TV, all this crazy stuff. And so just the mere thought of American prisons. Because people are just watching too much American TV. They freak. They freak the flip out. And you know what? If I was facing the possibility of being in an American prison, I'd freak out too. So I can't blame him. So he wants to stay in England, and I hope he can. And what's interesting about today's news, I already talked about how on October 16th, they're supposed to be deciding what they're going to do, whether they're going to extradite him or not. This has gotten up to the top ranks. I mean, the Prime Minister and the President have talked about this. Obama, the last time, says do what you want. And they haven't decided, so on October 16th, they're supposed to. However, a report did come out where the deputy prime minister has said, this is bunk, man. They're like, he's like, chill, dude. That he's essentially saying that this extradition law that we have with America should be scrapped. And a lot of people feel that way. Gary McKinnon would be here right now if other English people did not feel this way. Because they're upset about this extradition law. They think it's biased towards the U.S. And they ain't digging it. Nobody's digging the U.S. these days. They're kind of all getting mad at us. But what can you do? Come on. You know, it's not our fault all this stuff going down. Anyway, moving on. There was some news this week about a UFO being seen in the sky and some this is here in Arizona, and these strange pictures and everything, and it turned out to be a rocket test. Interesting enough, which is kind of weird, the rocket decided to shoot something out of White Sands, and people were able to see it for miles, and that doesn't seem very safe, and I hope that they don't do that anymore. Because that scares me, because people saw it out here in Arizona. I'm in the desert of Arizona. I'm not too far from Goldwater range. Don't shoot stuff out of your missile range, dudes, because it could land on me. And I would not appreciate that. So that's all to do with that story. Other sightings that made the news, there's UFO photographs that were taken in Africa over some diamond mines. I'm sorry, this is Canada. But still, over some Arctic diamond mines in Canada. It's a strange round circular cloud, and these three lights that seem to go down. A lot of people are saying, well, it looks like maybe something was reflecting from the window when they took the picture. It does look like that. It looks, I don't know, just a still picture, though, so it's difficult to say. This was in the International Business Times. Again, International Business Times writing about UFOs quite a bit. So thank you guys for being cool and writing about UFOs, because we all know that it's the coolest of the cool that writes about UFOs. Oh, yeah. Other UFO news, UFO sightings over Melbourne. Here's another one, 3AW693 Talk. We've got UFOs on the air. Has written about UFOs over Melbourne. That is in Australia, and this is an Australian news program. And somebody sent them some pictures, and they actually posted these pictures, and they did some analysis. And it looks very strange, whatever this is. that they're looking at. So you can go look at these pictures. Remember, if you go to UFODailyNews.com, you're going to see under the UFO news feed all of these stories. You can actually go to UFOThinkInc.com also, because that will redirect you to UFODailyNews.com, where you're going to find the latest UFO news, including these stories I'm covering and these pictures from Melbourne, Australia. Yeah, I don't know what to make of the pictures. Some people have said maybe it was a bird that was reflecting. It's very strange. It's almost like this saucer-shaped, like, yeah, it's very difficult to describe, I would say. So you're going to have to look at this thing. It is at night, and some light in the sky. So very interesting, though. Finally, a story on other Australian UFO sightings. So supposedly this is a story about some burn marks that were found in Perth. And these are stories by the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, so similar to the FAA. But of an orange light being seen on January 25th of last year, and something flying around of this sort, and it was also seen by a pilot. So it's a very short story, unfortunately. They don't have much here, but this has been posted by the Herald Sun, which is a paper out there in sunny Australia, where they have the outback and the crocodiles and the marsupials come from Australia. And marsupials are very strange, aren't they? I wonder if some people theorize that they are actually from another planet. And it's interesting to think that we have this breed of marsupials, such as a wallaby is a marsupial. You know, these strange animals here on this planet that you can't find anywhere else. I think that's cool. Speaking of Australia. So lots of UFO news out in Australia. They are UFO crazy as well, which is wonderful. The whole world round is just fascinated with this phenomena, as are we. You know who else is fascinated? I mean, they just can't get enough of UFO stuff. That is the National Atomic Testing Museum in sunny Las Vegas, Nevada, also in the middle of the desert. Well, it's where Tracy's from, who we're going to talk to in just a minute. But first, I want to mention this. But they are having a special lecture called Military UFOs, Secrets Revealed. Holy moly. The people here are going to be Colonel Bill Coleman. And this is significant, especially these two are really significant. Colonel Bill Coleman, he's retired. He's been retired for some time. He was the chief public affairs officer for Blue Book. So he worked on Blue Book. So that's why this is significant. Also, Colonel Robert Friend, who also worked in Blue Book. He was a director for a period of time. And, of course, Blue Book being the official UFO investigations by the U.S. Air Force, which ended in 1969. Now, these guys you can see here and there doing interviews, not too often, though. Especially you can see them in the 1980s. There was a video called UFOs Live. Terrible. It was really goofy. But it got a lot of people interested in this stuff. And there was some stuff that was kind of not bad, including some of the interviews and the interviews with these guys. You can actually see that if you go to the UFO Daily News YouTube. Because I posted that whole show, and I don't know that I've seen it pop in and out here and there, but I don't know anybody else who has the whole show posted. So it's something to watch, because it's definitely part of UFO history. But I'll tell you now, these guys are skeptics. They're major skeptics. They say pretty much that they didn't find anything in Blue Book that they couldn't explain away. That's pretty much their feeling, and has been their feeling for all along. I've talked to Lee Spiegel, who's going to be there. I might be there, to be honest. And he feels that Bill Coleman's possibly going to tell him about a secret. Now, I'll tell you next week what happens, because Lee's going to write about it. And Bill Coleman did have an incredible UFO sighting. But I'll bet you, here's my guess. I will prophesize for you that Bill Coleman will say, I do have a big secret to reveal, that the UFO that I saw, I'm sure that it was just a duck. Or it was probably an early unmanned aerial vehicle. Something like that. I mean, this guy's not going to come out after years and years of saying there's nothing to all this and say, especially when he's asked so much about it, obviously, and he's hidden from the limelight regarding all of this and come out and say, oh, yeah, UFO. However, even though, you know, we might not get some exciting news out of those two, it's going to be really cool. At least they're talking, and there's this whole presentation supposed to be videotaped. There are three other gentlemen who are going to be there. Nick Pope, who we've had on the show multiple times. Of course, I've talked about him a lot. He was worked the UFO desk for the UK Ministry of Defense. Also, Colonel John Alexander, who's also been on the show. He worked in non-lethal weapons, but also had a little working group of some friends and intelligence where they did look into paranormal and UFOs, and they believe there are UFOs. He's not so sure there's a grand conspiracy. And also Colonel Charles Holt, who we also had on the show, who was the deputy base commander at Bentwaters when there was that extraordinary UFO occurrence where these things had been seen for a couple days flying over the base and beaming lights. Colonel Holt saw this himself, lights being beamed into the weapons storage area. Some people gave Lee heck because he said Colonel Holt was the base commander. And actually, he was. He was the deputy base commander when it happened. He wrote up the report that actually went to the UK because they said, well, you know, we saw this thing land, but it was not on the base, so that's UK property. Let's write them a letter, say, hey, here's what happened. It's your problem now. Deal with it. Of which the UK said, oh, well, we don't know what to do, so they ignored it, supposedly. But he later became the Bentwaters base commander. So that's why Lee said that. And it is accurate, and I think that's very interesting to note that after his sighting and after he submitted a report on this sighting, that he still went on to become the base commander. And, of course, he's had a lot of interesting things to say, such as the other witnesses, such as Sergeant Peniston and I can't remember some of the other witnesses right now, I apologize, but said that they were debriefed by some mysterious group. And Colonel Holt says, yes, I do believe that some third-party intelligence group could have come in and debriefed them without my knowledge or the base commander's knowledge. It's like, whoa, dude. But these guys work that way. People doing whatever they want, I guess. So that's the whole show. So a lot of people. So it's going to be interesting. And that's in Las Vegas on Saturday night at 6 p.m. So get in your cars, head out there, and have a good time, people. Rock on. So we'll see what comes of that. And I'm sure on the next show I'll be talking about exactly that, what comes of it. If you want some more information, you can go to the National Atomic Testing Museum.org. And they're also going to have in November Seth Shostak. And, of course, this is the museum, if you remember me talking about it. And I have some pictures of it on my website where they have an area dedicated to Area 51. And this Area 51 exhibit is actually three-quarters UFOs and aliens. And so, you know, they're definitely playing up that mythology that there have been aliens and UFOs worked on at Area 51. Who knows, right? Very mysterious stuff. I'm telling you. So, without further ado, however, we do have a great interview with Tracy Austin. And you know what? Let's see what Tracy has to say about all this. I am happy to have back on the show Tracy Austin. Hello, how are you?
I am great, Alejandro, and thanks for having me back on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yes, well, it's exciting. You've got some big news. You've got a brand new book out.
I do indeed. Alien Encounters in the Western United States.
Mm-hmm.
9 true accounts in the book of actual alien encounters, alien abductions from people in the Western United States. We've got some cases from California, cases from Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
Utah as well, and Colorado.
Okay, great. I was going to ask. I'm kind of a Southwest guy, and of course, I'm from Colorado. You spent some time in Colorado also, though, didn't you?
Not in Colorado, no. No, my husband's from Colorado.
Oh, okay. And now you live in Las Vegas.
I do.
How's that been? How long have you been there?
Been here since 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great place to be, you know. It's world-class everything here, as
right.
I'm sure you know, you know. But I lived in California for about 5 years, and I have to say I do miss that ocean and the dolphins.
Yeah, I can see that. The ocean's beautiful.
It is. It's spectacular.
That's
so,
why the coast is so full of people.
That's right. But, you know, I haven't actually made a trip back since I lived here, you know, in 2006. Well, I tell a lie. I took a trip to Santa Barbara last September. That was a year ago, but it was literally an overnight thing. So that was the only trip I made back there.
Mm-hmm. So, and you've gathered some of these stories. Now, 9 accounts doesn't sound like a lot, but when you read the book, I mean, you've got a lot of different topics and things going on here.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like it's jam-packed full of a lot of information. Are these cases mostly abduction issues?
Yeah, they are. They are experiences, abduction issues. There is a section in there about alien implants as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had interviewed my dear friend, Dr. Roger Lear, who was so gracious about doing the interview for the book and allowing me to have actual photographic evidence of alien implants as seen under the electron microscope. So we have some photographs in here of those that were taken out from some of the patients of Dr. Lear. And like I said, he was, you know, very gracious to allow me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Lamb also writes a foreword for me in the book as well, which is from a regression therapist's point of view. I mean, Barbara is a well-known lady in her field of expertise, as I know you know, and she has regressed hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of people and very much knows that this is a real phenomena that is going on, just like Dr. Roger Lear, who has removed 16 alleged alien implants to date.
Mm-hmm. So when was it that you first heard about the abduction phenomena, and kind of how has your evolution gone as far as what you've learned and maybe how your thoughts may have changed on the phenomenon?
Well, to be honest with you, Alejandro, I first got into this whole subject in 1987. I think I covered it briefly on the previous show, but I was studying in London. I was training as a concert pianist there. And that's when I personally had my very first UFO sighting in the middle of London, 1987. And it got me to, it was almost as if they said to me, you know, you're not going to go down this path that you think you're going to go down. You're going to go down this path, and you're going to learn what we are all about. It really stemmed from that sighting, to be honest with you, and went to various conferences, both in England and the United States. Got to meet with people on the lecture circuit. Of course, you know, you make friends with these people. You get to find out what they're researching and their involvement. And abductions, it seems, have been always to the forefront of this. And I know a lot of people have remained quiet about it. You know, they didn't want to come out of the woodwork to talk about it because of fear of ridicule and rejection and, you know, the feeling of people are going to think I'm an absolute raving nutcase. But as the years have gone by, since 87, it seems that more and more people have been involved. And the research in my book for this has led me to believe that 4 million Americans have had abduction experiences. Those are just the people coming forward. What about the people who are not coming forward? Has to be a higher number. And certainly worldwide, we've got to be in the number of maybe close to 10, 11 million maybe worldwide.
All right. When you come to that number 4 million, how do you get to that number?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
It's a big number.
It's a big number. This is based on Roper polls. This is based on a couple of Roper polls out there that I based my research on. So that is what the number is suggesting. And those are the people that have come forward and talked about it and believe that they've had this phenomena happen to them.
Gotcha. So you've taken a poll, and if it says like 2% of the people say in the poll that they've had an experience, then 2% of the overall population is how you get the number?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, gotcha.
Right.
Right, that would be a lot of people. Now, I guess one of the questions that also comes up is, in your situation, you felt kind of like you had a communication or some guidance, which you followed in your experience. However, of course, when you look into the abduction phenomena, some of those people feel that it's a very negative experience. How have you kind of categorized those things, or how do you view that difference?
Well, it does come across that way, to be honest with you, Alejandro. There doesn't seem to be anything positive for the experiencer or the abductee whose involvement has been with this. It seems to be all one-sided. Just as, you know, Dr. David Jacobs has said in his book, The Threat and Secret Life, the late John Mack in his abduction work, the late Bud Hopkins, and I hate to say the late, you know, late Bud Hopkins and late John Mack, it's hard to believe they're no longer with us, because their work is so phenomenal. But they have all suggested that there's nothing really positive to this for the experiencer. It's one-sided. This is an agenda that these beings have, and they're going to do it no matter what it takes. It's of extreme importance to them. I am of the opinion also, like I said, that it does seem to come across that way. But there's always two sides to a coin. Well, actually, three sides to a coin. But I think it's how we are looking at this. We don't know if these implants, for example, are of extreme benefit to us. We just don't know. I know that Dr. Leah, you know, when he first got involved with the whole alien implant theme, thought that he just wanted to prove to people that this was regular stuff that he was taking out of the body, you know, the foot, because he's a podiatrist, that it could be plastic, glass, hair, you know, something from the beach, maybe a piece of shell or whatever. But when he came to take them out and have them analyzed, this was proving that this was something completely different from what he's taken out of the body before. So he became a believer from all of that. So who really knows what benefit these implants are for? We don't know. I mean, he thought that they were tracking devices at first, but then came to the conclusion, well, no, they can't be tracking devices because these beings can actually find you anywhere. They don't need an object to locate you. So then it came down to the other assumption that it was for monitoring our DNA, monitoring how our body is functioning. These beings are following family lineage. They're family, following family bloodlines. And like I said, you know, it's how we are interpreting it also, I think, as a human being. We need to be able to look at all aspects of it. But on the surface, it sure does seem to be a negative connotation, and I can understand people thinking that way.
Mm-hmm. Although it sounds as though you don't feel that your experience, at least, the was negative.
No, it wasn't. Mine was totally positive, Alejandra. Mm-hmm. It really was.
Now, and I'll get more into that. We'll talk about maybe some different agendas and stuff. But I wanted to touch on some of the things that you were talking about here, especially about the bloodlines and the implants. Now, the people who are abducted typically have kind of some communications or at least some kind of ideas. In the cases that you're covering here or maybe just in your research, have you found that someone, maybe the people you wrote about that who Dr. Lear removed an implant from, did they know that was in there? Do they remember it being put in there? And have they ever asked or been told what that was all about?
Yeah, in many of the cases, they at first did not know that the implant was actually in there, and under certain circumstances came to find out that there was indeed something. For example, I talk about a case in the book of a gentleman from Colorado whose name is Tim. In fact, you know, I think everybody perhaps knows Tim Cullen, mm-hmm. who is he's been on documentaries, and Dr. Roger Lear removed his implant. He did not know he had an implant in his wrist and had sightings. He had sightings with his wife, Janet. And it was only until one particular case, as a construction worker at the time, that he accidentally hit his hand with a hammer and took himself to the emergency room to get it checked. And they took x-rays because, you know, the hand was severely damaged by this hammer, and took x-rays, and they saw on the x-ray that, hey, you have a piece of metal in your wrist here. Do you know that you have this? Are you aware of it? Well, Tim spoke about the fact that immediately as the doctor had suggested this to him, his mind went right back to the time when he'd had the encounter with his wife, where he saw the craft and the craft hovering above the vehicle, and then knew at that point that I must have gone on board. I must have been taken. This is what they had done to me. And, of course, he's tried to have regression therapy to uncover all of that event. But like most abductees, they get to a certain point, and you can't get beyond the wall. He's blocked from doing that, which is what these beings tend to do, as I'm sure you're aware. They suppress the information. So then, like I said, you know, he was of the belief that, well, this is what they've put in here. And Dr. Roger Lear asked him, you know, well, do you want it to leave it in or do you want it removed? And he said, no, I really want this thing out. And just like every other abductee that has these things, they feel this new sense of freedom, this newfound freedom once these objects are gone and out of the body. But I have to say that one of the cases in the book also, Alice, she did not know that she had an implant in her calf, in her left leg. After an encounter in 1994 at the Del Coronado Island in San Diego, where there was a whole host of things going on with abductions, at that time when President Clinton was there visiting the town. And the whole place was swarming with Secret Service people, and it was she just couldn't believe that perhaps they would not know that something like this had taken place with about 15 to 17 people. And it was only after that time at the conference in 1996 that she met Dr. Lear. And she was told, she said, by a voice, and she's not prone to hearing voices, by the way, that look at your leg, look down at your leg. And so she followed the instruction. She looked down at her leg, and she noticed a scoop mark, like a kidney-shaped scoop mark. That's when she approached Dr. Lear and told him of what had happened. And he obviously put it on x-ray, and there it was. There was the object. And again, asked her, what do you want to do? Do you want to keep this in, or do you want to have it removed? And she said, no, of course I want it removed. And I think Roger had actually gained some funding at the time to do three different surgeries. And Willie Strieber was meant to be one of those three people to have his implant removed from his earlobe. But he backed out at the last minute and said that he felt removing this thing may lead to some kind of bad health. There'd be health issues. So he backed out. He didn't want it removed. And Alice was the lady who went in his place as the third person with this funding that Roger managed to gain.
Mm-hmm. Now that these implants are removed, you know, now we have something physical. And I think a lot of people wonder this. Of course, I've talked to Dr. Lara. I know some of the answers. But I want your perspective on, you know, I think a lot of people, they probably ask you, well, if you have an implant, then why don't you figure out what it is?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got to go through the necessary steps, obviously, to find out what it is, whether it's an MRI, it's a CAT scan or whatever, and take the necessary steps from there. You have to remember with this, which I'm sure you are aware of, Alejandro, there is no portal of entry as to how these things actually got in there, which is of extreme interest. I mean, these things are made of meteorite. How does a piece of meteorite get in someone's body? So you've got to take the logical steps and, maybe hook up with Dr. Leon and find out if he can be of help to this person who may think they have an implant and see what comes forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did those? Were there other effects when the implants were removed that the people you wrote about felt?
Yeah, they all pretty much said that they found a new sense of freedom once they had this object removed. Alice, however, was a little different. Alice actually became quite nauseated, once this was removed, she became quite nauseated and didn't feel too good once it was removed. She never actually said as such that she felt this newfound freedom, but she was starting to have, you know, physical effects from having it removed. She has actually been on board the craft and sort of had dealings with these beings when she removed her implant. They do not like it. She categorically said, these people do not like it when you have them removed. Now, obviously, they don't show any type of human emotion like we do, aggression or frustration. They're different. Obviously, their makeup is far different. But she said she could just tell. She just got a feeling from it once they knew she'd had it removed and basically just put another one inside her ear and said, you won't remove this.
And has she been able to do, like, an x-ray to see that that is there, and is she thinking about removing it?
I don't believe she is removing it, no. I think she's going to leave it in there. Same with a guy that I spoke to in Utah, a guy named Ron in the book. He has one behind his left ear. And spoke to Dr. Lear about it a few years ago, actually. And Roger said, well, you know, if I can help you if you feel you want to have this removed. And he said, well, you know, I think I would like it to be removed, to be honest with you, because this would help science. This could help science in such a big way to find out what these things really are. However, 3 days later, he was re-abducted and told, under no certain circumstances, you are not to remove this implant. It has to stay in, and it is of utmost importance. So, again, Ron has the implant in his ear to this day.
Mm-hmm. So, moving away from the implant, I mean, it's really interesting, and we'll probably touch on it again, but you also mentioned the bloodlines. Have you found that in the cases that you've looked at with the abductions that a child and or parent has also had these experiences, that it does seem to be a multi-generational type of thing?
Absolutely. Most of the cases in the book are generational. There's one in particular, a case in there, which is John's experience, who is actually a scientist. And John, his wife, and all of his three children are involved with this phenomena. And for example, the smaller child, he's got two boys and a girl. The smaller child, who's, I think she's four, told J- John one day how she was afraid of the trash truck. And he said, well, what do you mean you're afraid of the trash truck? She says, well, Daddy, it reminds me of the ship that comes down and the people that take me up into the sky at night. So, I mean, how can you refute that? You know, children don't lie. Children tell it like it is.
Right.
Children don't need to, you know, fabricate. They're pure. And they have actually been seen, him and one of his sons in particular, on board the craft by someone else that he knows who's an abductee, who's physically seen him and his son on board the ship.
Really?
Yeah. And he said, I was just blown away. I was just blown away by the fact that that had happened, which lends more, even more credibility
mm-hmm.
to the whole thing, you know? So, yeah, and he feels, you know, when his wife was first pregnant, they'd gone on a trip to, I think it was somewhere in Arizona, the Grand Canyon. His wife, back about 9 o'clock one evening, decided that she needed to go out to the Grand Canyon and asked John to drive them there. And he thought, well, why would she be asking to do this at 9 o'clock at night? You know, it didn't make any sense. He said, but I complied. I went with it, and we drove out there. And the closer I'm reaching the point that we're going to, I feel really uneasy. And I feel like we shouldn't go any further. I feel that we have to turn back. Well, she kind of felt the same way when they reached a certain point, but didn't know why. The next thing they know, that they're turning back and they're going back to the hotel. A few days later, they started to have little flashbacks of what had actually happened to them. And as it turned out, to the point that they had got to a section in the road before they made the turning where they needed to go, a UFO had come down in that particular clearing of the road. And that's at the precise point where they said, they have to go, they have to turn back, it didn't feel right, and they should leave. Well, what had actually transpired, that John remembered that the beings had asked him to pull his car over and to wait. At that time, his wife actually physically goes up through the seatbelt, through the roof of the car, and into the waiting craft above the vehicle. And he said, "All I could do was wait. There's nothing I could do." So it was about 10 minutes. He was getting concerned that his wife wasn't brought back. 15 by 20 minutes, she came back. She was brought back the same way that she'd left the vehicle. She came through the roof of the car and slipped back down into the seatbelt, which is, I mean, that is phenomenal. The whole thing of that was phenomenal. And that's when they said they felt uneasy, they should turn around and go back. As it turns out, what they had done when John was abducted a couple of weeks later, they had told John, these grey people, that they had given his wife the equivalent of like an amniocentesis, and that they had indeed placed this needle inside his wife's abdomen and had to do this. And this was for the purpose of the child. And John believes that what this was for is they were actually interfering with the child. They were interfering with the child's DNA. And he asked them never, ever, ever to please do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Never have my wife experience anything like that again. Well, these beings turned around and said to John, well, we won't, as long as she doesn't get pregnant again. So they're very interested. He says, for some reason, they have an interest in my children. And John is a scientist, and he's got that background. He's got that science mind and believes that they open up to him a little bit more about, you know, things to do with the craft, the propulsion of the craft, show him different things. Like they've taken him to the dark side of the moon, showed him where they build their craft. More than they would an average person being taken, because John can understand it better.
So does he feel then that he has an idea, or what are his feelings on the motivations, why they're doing this, and if it, why they seem to be taking people along his bloodline and this sort of thing?
They, according to John, and like a lot of people, it's this hybridization. They need specific characteristics of your DNA. Whatever that is, we don't know. But if we look at some of the people that, well, the majority of people that they're taking, these people in the majority are, they come from an arts background, or they're very scientific-minded, or they have psychic intuitive abilities. Their personalities are just different from, you know, other people. Whether there's a certain understanding there, I don't know. It seems to be the case. But he's talked about hybridization, the fact that this is part of their program. He knows that... he has hybrid children on board the ship. He's met them. And again, they are interested in his children. He's even actually taken infrared lights, and when his children have had encounters, he's sort of scanned their body with these ultraviolet lights and things to see if they have been taken, and fingerprints have been left on the children. He doesn't pressurize the children into telling him or, you know, his wife what has happened to them. He kind of lets the children be free with that, and when they feel they want to speak to their parents about it, they come to them and talk about it. But again, everything, like Dr. David Jacobs has said in his books, John Mack, Wood Hopkins, it's all about this reading program. It's of extreme importance to them.
And the gentleman you're talking about now, he doesn't seem like he has a combative relationship with these beings, and it seems to be at least for him a little more back and forth than the other people experience. So does he have a negative feeling towards these entities, or?
I think it's kind of half and half. I think it was pretty much negative to begin with, Alejandro, because he didn't know how to deal with this kind of thing. And certainly he didn't want his children and his wife involved with this kind of thing. But as the years have gone by, he's been more complying with them on a level of some kind of understanding because of the nature of how they talk to him, how they share information, because of his science background that he can handle it. So it's one that's more of a slightly friendlier terms than what it previously was. Mm-hmm. And with some people it is that way. With some people they absolutely loathe it, they hate it, they wish it had never happened, they wish it had just go away and stop. They don't want this. It's interfering with their lives, their marriages, their relationships. So it's... It differs from a person to person.
A lot of abductees talk about, you know, the typical gray that we envision, you know, and we see images of around being involved with abducting them. And when you interviewed all of these different people, did they have similar descriptions of the beings and their craft?
They did. The majority of these nine cases have all been dealing with gray entities, which, you know, apparently there are different types of gray entities. There's not just one particular type. Ron from Utah, for example, had first encountered a very tall gray that was around about seven feet tall or so. And he said he knew that because of the ceiling, his 9-foot ceiling. So he knew that this being was approximately 7 feet tall, not your typical kind of gray that is, you know, 3.5-4 feet tall. There are also reptilian beings that have been mentioned. There's a case in the book from Dina and Chris, who are residents here in Las Vegas, who were taken to certain incubatoriums on board the ship. And Dina in particular said that while she was there in this incubatorium, there was a reptilian standing guard, watching what was going on, watching that everybody was complying with what they were asked to do. And that's quite an interesting case in itself, because for Dina, she was taken when she was 16 years of age. And there were other girls, maybe six or seven other girls of the same age, who she did not know, but saw them on the craft. And she described a huge wall that had ambient lighting from behind it. And in the wall were about 30 baskets, 30 drawers. I didn't know what was in them at first, didn't know where they were, until a being came through and approached them and said to the 16-year-olds, each and every one of them, that we want you to open up the basket. We want you to take the baby out of the basket, and we want you to hold and nurture it. And we want you to hold it to your breast to feed it. And Dina said, well, that's ridiculous. That's impossible. We can't do that. We haven't given birth to these babies. We have no milk. And she said that she was just instructed just to do it from this being. So that's what every single girl did. They took out every single baby from the basket. They complied and held the baby to their breasts as if they were feeding the babies. And this reptilian was standing guard, watching what was going on, that everyone was complying.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chapter in the book that I write about the tall whites that are supposedly out there at Indian Springs, which actually I don't live too far from. And that one of the a guy wrote about, Charles Hall, his trilogy, that he'd actually worked out there and seen these tall whites during his duties of a weather observer. So we have those as well. We also have let me see here, it's pretty much like a trickster type of being. I kind of saw a being similar to this from my experiences, but there was no face with mine. And this one, you can actually see the faces of the face of this being that has wrinkles or folds, if you like, in the face. Kind of dark black eyes. It's called a dwarf alien being, often referred to as a trickster, one who likes to play games with the experiencer. Is often been seen, you know, pulling the bed covers off the individual or trying to tickle the experiencer as they lie there sleeping. And I actually spoke at the Women's 2012 UFO Conference in Texas that my good friend Paula Harris had put on back in May. I hosted it and spoke there. And as soon as I put up on the slides this particular being, I had a lady that started to talk to me about it and asked me, could I, you know, give her information of where she could research this being, because she actually had an encounter with this same type of being. And she said, I was absolutely floored when I saw the slide come up of this being. So, you know, she was happy to see that other people were involved with this type of being. And, of course, you've got the Nordic beings as well that look very similar to the Pleiadians. Beautiful features, very angular, beautiful blue eyes, blonde hair, seem to be very, very benevolent and with a totally different type of agenda.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talked about the hybridization and seeing the babies, it seems that the characteristics of these hybrid babies that have been described are usually kind of half human, half gray. But in mentioning all of these other entities, have you had any stories where it seems like maybe it's these other entities that are mixed in with human characteristics?
Not from my research with these nine accounts, no.
Mm-hmm. So does it seem that then this hybrid, it's just kind of, it seems like it's their program, the grays, it's their program, but then there are these other entities around that somehow are supportive or play some sort of role.
Yeah, it seems to be that way, and don't know why that is. I know that many abductees have seen different types of beings on board the ship, just like Travis Walton did, you know, when he saw humanoid-looking beings that thought that they were there to help him get off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I thought they were here to help me escape and get off here. But no, they weren't. They were kind of like in cahoots with these smaller entities. So they all seem to be sharing some kind of space with each other, you know, in and supporting of what is going on.
Mm-hmm. So with that, have you ran across, are all of your stories, abduction stories, are there also encounters that didn't have anything to do with an abduction or at least any sort of medical examination?
They all seem to be involved with that procedure, in all honesty. There's only one in the case in the book, which is the case of Chris. She does not remember being on a table of any kind, having any experiments done to her. But she does remember, again, just like Dina, being taken to an incubatorium. She was met by a very, very tall female ET that was bald, actually, and had beautiful blue eyes, who took her through the ship. She said that she went through the actual console room where they flew the ship, they operated the craft. She saw a huge window that was kind of like a beveled window where you could see out in space, stars upon stars upon stars. She went through there and through kind of like the waiting area where she was initially, taken through to the back end of that where there was the incubatorium. And this female ET had opened up a basket again from a wall with ambient lighting and placed this baby in her arms, in Chris's arms, and asked her again to, like, just like Dina, you know, to hold the baby, to love it, to nurture it. And at this point, she said that the baby just looked so cute to her. It raised its tiny hand and held on to her little finger. And she said, you know, she got quite emotional about that situation. But it's very interesting. It's like I said, you know, most of those cases out of the nine have all had experiments of some kind, apart from Chris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very weird. Now, a couple of other kind of that, it's already a fringe subject, but I mean, I was going to say some of the other, I guess, theories around what's happening. Of course, some people have mentioned that they feel there has been military involvement with their abduction experiences. Have any of these people that you talked to ran across anything like that?
Chris had an experience where, you see, Chris is a very talented lady where she's able to meditate, leave her body, and travel astrally. And she feels that in one of her encounters, she was actually taken to Area 51. She described the runway, she described the buildings, and she said she wanted to put it out there because she wanted to find out if anyone else had these experiences and seen what she had seen there. She did remember that while she was out at Area 51, that she was being approached by these jeeps. And at first, she thought that she was being approached with what she called like small... She didn't know they were greys. She didn't... I forget the term that she actually called them, but she didn't think they were greys at first. But as they got closer and closer, she realized that, oh my gosh, these are greys. And so her jeep had kind of, not her jeep, I think she was traveling in a vehicle actually at the time, had turned over in a ravine. And as she was hiding behind this vehicle that she was in, she noticed these jeeps coming towards her with these small people and was hiding behind the vehicle. And suddenly, one of these Nordic beings appeared to help her escape and taken to somewhere which she thought was a cave. And he's showing her all of these different kinds of symbols and writings on the cave wall. So that's interesting. I mean, I don't know if there was any military involvement with an abduction with her, especially, but she never mentioned it. But I just thought it was very odd how she had ended up in Area 51.
Yeah, it's an interesting, and this whole event took place out of body?
Yes, apparently so. She was in some kind of meditative state. She had a friend in Australia, I think it is, not Australia, Canada, and they decided to actually do some kind of an experiment together with the group in Canada and with Chris here in Las Vegas. And it was dealing with astral travel. And Chris decided that her focus and her mission of astral traveling was going to actually be at the location of Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that once she was in a meditative state and experienced being in the zone of astral traveling, she found herself driving a Jeep that was losing control. And as she drove through a ravine, within moments, the vehicle ended up turning on its side, throwing Chris out of it. Immediately, she said she felt the need to hide, as coming up a long stretch of road was an army of very small men in many, many Jeeps. And heading from what appeared to be the super secret base of Area 51. So at a distance, she said she thought the men, and that's the word I was looking for, she thought the men were to be Peruvians.
Huh.
That's the word she used, Peruvians, as they were fairly dark-skinned, and she thought to be Indian-looking. But as they came closer, she realized that, no, they were, in fact, gray beings.
Yeah, interesting story. Now, with... I lost my train of thought. I had a great question. But then you brought up another point, which is just the variety. I mean, there are a lot of these incidents, or at least people having these with these sort of stories, and you've probably ran across dozens of them. How did you choose this 9 in particular?
I did not know of anyone out here in Las Vegas, for example. So what I did, I contacted a lady named Misha Johnson here of Las Vegas. She has an abduction experiencer support group. And I told her that I was looking for abductees to write about in my new book. So she invited me along to the group, and I met with her members and got to listen to some of the encounters. And Dina's encounter and Chris's encounter particularly stood out, and I thought they would be really great for the book. So that's why I chose those two in particular. I had also met Ron from Utah at Misha Johnson's group, and he has a right cracking story. You know, so he just had to be in the book because of his experience. And then the others were people who Dr. Roger Lear had put my way because he'd removed their implants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I came up with the 9, and they're great, great stories. I wanted to put more in the book, actually, but it's taken 12 months to write this,
right.
And I wanted to, you know, get it out there and to move on to other things. So I just chose 9 for the book.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's a lot. I'm sure there's a lot to read with these 9 stories because there are so many stories you could write forever.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, I would have liked more, but like I said, I just wanted to try and get to the point after 12 months, so I really need to wrap this up now and get the book out there.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a feeling in your experience in dealing with this for a few decades now that I kind of have this feeling, but it's difficult to qualify or to quantify, that it seems in the 90s especially was that there were a lot of abductions happening and they seem to have petered off as much. Do you believe that, or do you think, you know, it's been going as strong as it ever has?
I think it's been going as strong as it ever has, to be honest with you, Alejandro.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to conferences or things that people send me via email, you know, it just proves to me that this is ongoing and we don't know when this project of theirs is going to come to completion. They had told a couple of abductees that, yes, it will come to completion. But again, with these beings, they're so secretive. They never give a timeline. Are they being deceitful? Are they just telling us that? We don't know. I had gone to, as I mentioned, I'd spoken at the conference in May in Texas, Paul Harris's conference. And I was talking about implants in my talk. And at the end of it, I had a young lady that came up to me, and she says, can I talk with you for a moment? And I said, sure. She says, I think I have one of those implants that you're talking about. I said, really? She said, yeah, I do. I said, well, what makes you think that? Why do you think that? She says, well, I have it on x-ray. So I thought, okay, let's delve into this a little bit further. So she said she had gone to have a mammogram, a regular mammogram, and they'd seen something quite odd. So they sent her to a specialist. So she went to see the specialist and went through a whole numerous different tests to see what this, you know, abnormality was. So the doctor says to her at the end of all of the testing, when you get dressed, please come and see me in my office because I want to talk to you for a moment. So she went into his office and he raised the question. He said, I just want to ask you, have you ever been shot? And she said, shot? She says, no. What makes you think that? He says, well, have you ever been shot, like even just buck riding? She says, no, never, never been shot. He says, well, you have a piece of metal in your left breast. And this is triangular in shape. And what makes it even more odd is that you have no scarification to this thing as to how it got in there. And he says, then turns to her, Alejandro, and get this, you know, he says to her, this is a doctor saying this, you're not one of these people who has an alien implant, are you?
Oh, wow.
So I was blown away. I was totally blown away by the story. So I asked her what she wanted to do. Did she want it to remove it? She said, well, the doctor says if you want this thing removed, I can remove it. And she didn't go along with that. And I said, well, why don't we get you some help, first of all? Why don't we try and find a regression therapist for you so that you can find out who put this in here, why they put it in there, if we can get to know why. Usually we don't know why. And take it from there. So she agreed that that was the best scenario to go down. So I managed to locate a regression therapist for her, and she's going through that scenario before she decides what she would like to do. Mm-hmm. But I have the x-ray. She sent me the x-ray, and sure enough, there is the triangle piece of metal in her left breast.
Now, did she feel this doctor was just kind of being silly, or did he seem to be actually interested in the phenomena?
No, he seemed to be interested in the phenomena. The thing is, later she told me, like a week later, the doctor's surgery had completely gone and vanished.
Oh, he was gone.
Gone.
Oh wow.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, couldn't even go back and follow anything up with this man because the surgery was completely gone.
Mm-hmm. Because that's one of the unique things about Dr. Lear is that he is qualified. He's done this surgery and. And there aren't a lot of doctors who are willing to invest time or effort in this area.
Mm. Yeah, Dr. Roger Lear is a pioneer in this whole thing. And as far as I'm aware, the only person doing this. I had spoken to her about Dr. Lear. And I said that, if she wanted to have it removed, we could probably approach Dr. Lear, who would bring in a surgeon to assist with the removal of that, because Dr. Lee is a podiatrist, so I don't think he could actually remove anything from the breast area, but would assist most likely with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how this develops and where this goes. But out of all of the cases I've ever, you know, heard of, not only for the book, but over 20 years or so of my research, I have never come across anybody that's had an implant in their breast. This is the first of its kind to me.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, and maybe if we could talk your thoughts on the future of this research, because, I mean, these stories have been coming for a while, and luckily then, you know, Dr. Lear did come across and begin removing these things, even though he was skeptical at first. Do you think we'll learn more, or do you think this will stay enigmatic and forever?
Well, that's a really good question, and unfortunately, I don't have an answer to that. I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know how intense and how far beyond this project is that they are dealing with that they're trying to, you know, complete, if they are trying to complete it. I don't know. I'm kind of the same kind of mind as Dr. David Jacobs, to be honest with you. You know, when he talks about that there's a definite beginning and a middle to this, and probably at some point an end to this alien agenda. He's of the opinion, and I think I have to agree, that after, you know, he's hypnotically regressed all these hundreds upon hundreds of people, and through what he's uncovered during those regressions, that the results suggest that there could be an end to this being's project, which concludes them infiltrating in our society alien-human hybrids from their program. And he talks about, you know, he's not actually hopeful of what that outcome would be, the future would be for our planet. For he believes that there would be no other possible reason for aliens to create such a hybrid race if, in fact, they were not about to seed them here to coexist with humankind. And I have to wonder the same thing, Alejandro. I have to speculate that. I mean, are there not already hybrids among us? Apparently, people have seen hybrids. Ingo Swann, the remote viewer, had, you know, met with a hybrid or an avatar in a grocery super, in a supermarket in the middle of California, and there's been many others who have seen hybrids. So maybe they are preparing us for that to happen. You know, the ultimate intention of these alien beings is to seed them here amongst us. So who knows? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a fascinating phenomena.
Yeah, so difficult. And it's difficult to say, I think, when that beginning is. Who knows how far it goes back, if not thousands of years, if not to the beginning of mankind. Who knows?
Of course. Yeah, there's numerous questions to be raised regarding it, and it's a challenging phenomena, and the more questions that we seem to raise, the more they do seem to outweigh the answers. I think there's probably a couple of main questions to ask here. You know, is the phenomena then solely to do with perhaps the preservation of life here on Earth, and will this alien breeding program be of any benefit to us as a civilization?
Mm-hmm.
Who the heck knows?
Yeah, no doubt that we aren't the best stewards of the planet Earth at this point, so who knows. And it's also, because it seems as though you would feel, because of your experience in particular, that there are other entities out there with more positive agendas.
For sure. There absolutely is, you know, and more often than not, you know, the whole thing, religious thing of, well, where does God play in all of this with all of these races and these different people? Well, of course, there can only be only one, you know. And as it is said and stated in the Bible, in my Father's house there are many mansions. That's what that's implying, surely, that we are not the only people here that he would seed. There are many races that we know nothing about. It's a vast universe out there. And, you know, it's claimed that these gray entities are coming from Zeta Reticuli, which is 39 light years, according to Stanton Friedman. It's just down the street. It's not that far. So who knows how many life forms there are out there? There has to be, you know, many, many, many that we'll never probably encounter in our lifetime, but are here for sure, some of them visiting our planet. We're an abundance of life. Mm-hmm. So why would you not come here if you have a project that you want to fulfill?
Yeah, interesting. So in your book, you've got a lot of these beautiful illustrations also, and they're done by Christine Dennett. And she did these, I take it, from people describing to her their experiences?
She did indeed. She's a phenomenal artist. Somehow she's able to tune into these people. And I'm sure she has a psychic ability of some kind, because she's able to do it with such accuracy and portray in her drawings of what these beings actually look like. So I was honored that she was able to do that for the book. And we have about five pieces of artwork in here of these different beings that people are encountering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at them at the website here, and they're great pictures. And the cover is pretty striking, and I take it that that is also taken from firsthand experience?
It is indeed, yeah. This was a case I actually investigated in England. And she's named Roxanne in the book. I've changed her name for obvious reasons. But this was taken from a scene that she drew for me of what had happened of her and being found as an abductee on a table and being presented by a hybrid child and was asked to hold this hybrid child because this was her child. And Roxanne got up off that table and put her hands in front of her and said, "No, I cannot hold this child." She said it was the most creepiest, weirdest looking child ever and had something to do with them. This was not by far a human child. This had something to do with their genetics. Would not hold it, didn't want to be a part of it. She actually had an alien implant in her jaw, by the way, that was shown on X-ray. And I said to her at the time, you know, "Well, would you like to have this removed?" And she said, yes, she would. I said, "Well, let me talk with my dentist and see if we can get this removed. But on the understanding that once the object is removed, that it would stay in my possession." She agreed to it. And, of course, as we got closer to getting this finalized, she backed out. She said she didn't want to do it. She felt she should leave it in there. And this is the same thing that we get over and over and over and over with these abductees, that some kind of mind control, I'm guessing, from these beings that are telling them, no, you have to leave that in there. You can't remove it. Mm-hmm. So I think to this day she must probably still have it in there.
Mm-hmm. And do her experiences continue that you know of?
I haven't been in contact with her for a very long time, so I don't know. Chances are they most likely are, because her mother also had encounters. Again, we've got this lineage thing going on, although her mother didn't want to talk about it too much at the time. It was purely, you know, Roxanne's encounters that she wanted to talk to me about. So she said this thing in her jaw would buzz every time they were getting closer and an encounter would happen, but she would hear it in her ear. And her dog, the pet dog, would go ballistic. It would run around in circles, run up and down the house, just acting really wild. Couldn't control the dog. And this would go on for about an hour. So I don't know. Maybe your encounters are still ongoing.
Maybe the dog has an implant.
Who knows? Maybe so. I mean, this is again, I mean, how do we know how far this this thing goes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, his implant.
It's often, I think, interesting, too, that people, I mean, this is a very traumatic experience, of course, if these beings are coming and taking people out of their bed. It's there's just so many interesting and weird things about it. Of course, you know, some people seem to be taken out of neighborhoods where, you know, there's a bunch of people there, but somehow they're taken without being noticed. And also, people seem, they have to move on with their life, of course, but they seem able to cope with something that to an outside person would be something that might be incopable.
Well, yeah, I think some do. Some have a real issue with coping with it because it's and it was the same for Roxanne's case. You know, I mean, she was a young 20-year-old and the things that happened to her, people would think, well, you know, this is typical of a 20-year-old. You know, she can't hold a job down. She's not, she's in and out of relationships. But she termed that happening to her because of her encounters. She lost perspective on what was reality. And I think this is the case with a lot of people. They have a hard time dealing with this. And who can you go to talk to about it? You know, they have to find local groups that support groups, like Misha Johnson's group here in Las Vegas. Got to find understanding people who can openly share things with and be exceptional listeners. Some people do cope. I mean, I've coped with my encounters fine. I don't have an issue with it. But there are many out there who don't, and this is very traumatic for them. You know, you mentioned that abductees are taken from the most strangest places. Yeah, in England, there was one guy that was taken from one house after going to see a David Bowie concert and placed in someone's different house.
Hmm.
I mean, how does that happen? I mean, it seems that these people make mistakes.
Wow.
You know, there's Bud Hopkins and John Mack had a conversation about this very thing a number of years ago, where Bud talks about his clients, two of his clients were abducted and placed back in each other's vehicle, not in their own vehicle. And as they're driving down the highway, they realize that they're in each other's vehicle. Well, the beings must have picked up on this, re-abducted them, and then placed them back in the right vehicle.
Really?
Yes. I mean, that is so bizarre.
Very bizarre stuff.
So they make mistakes. Why do they make mistakes? You know, they apparently, according to a neurologist guy that I'd spoken to a few years ago, had a couple of high-ranking Area 51 people seeing him as his clients. And he said one guy opened up about this whole thing and talked about the fact we'll be working with them out there at Area 51. They have an IQ of 300. Mm-hmm. They have an IQ of 300, but they're placing people back in the wrong vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen?
And this neurologist shared this information with you?
Shared this information, yeah. Because at the time, my first book was coming out, Haunted Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And we got talking about that, and of course, one subject led to another. And of course, my favorite subject is extraterrestrials, alien encounters. And we got talking about that, and he openly shared it.
Wow.
He said that this guy, his wife was terminally ill with cancer and wanted to quit what he was involved with so he could spend time and look after her. She hadn't got long to live. And he said, you know, for what he was involved with out there at Area 51, they wouldn't let him do it. He said, so I'm just going to speak and openly talk about it as it is. He said, I don't give a damn. You know, what they say to me, they can kill me, shoot me, whatever they want to do. Well, we are working categorically with 4-foot-tall gray entities out there at Area 51 underground, and we are back engineering craft, and that these beings have an IQ of 300.
Hmm.
And that's what he shared.
Wow. Was the neurologist able to or willing to get you in touch with this person?
Well, we didn't go that far. I mm-hmm. doubt whether he would have, you know, that would have actually been possible. You know how it is. But, you know, I know who he is. I could perhaps, you know, try and follow up at a later stage with him.
Yeah, especially if someone's willing to open up. And you would think a lot of those Area 51 workers work right there in Las Vegas, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I had interviewed, actually, a cleaner at one of the test sites. I don't think she was actually at Area 51. She was at a different test site. And she did not want to give her name. She didn't really want to come forward. I had to coax her a little bit through her daughter to answer, I think, 13 questions that I had for her at the time. And I'd placed them on my website so that people could read it. But she talked about very openly how cleaning this facility one day, she was in one of the rooms, and there was a binder on top of one of the worktops, work surfaces. And she accidentally knocked it onto the floor. And out fell from this binder ID tags. She says, and as I bent down to pick up the ID tags that had fallen from the binder, I noticed that they were actually alien beings.
Hmm.
There were photographs of alien beings on those ID tags with their own number. She said, so I came to the conclusion, oh, my God. They're out here working with us. So she said she quickly scooped up the ID tags, she put them into the binder, and she put the binder back on top of the worktop, like nothing had happened. She says, but these were the typical gray type beings that we are seen, you know, we're shown on TV, TV programs, TV documentaries, etc.
And they even get issued security badges, huh?
It appears so. She said that each one had a photograph, and underneath it was a number.
Well, there are some interesting things going on in the deserts around you there, huh?
There are, for sure. And I don't know if it's, you know, if it's going to stay, you know, it's going to have quiet moments or whether this is a repeated thing. I mean, I've had sightings out here, and it would be nice if more and more people came forward to open up about the subject.
Mm-hmm. And so people can go to TracyAustin.com to get your book?
They can go to letstalkparanormal.com.
Okay, letstalkparanormal.com.
Yeah, they can do that. They can actually get it directly from my publisher, who is Schiffer.
Okay.
They go on amazon.com, or they could go to a local bookstore. It's in Barnes & Noble as well. So most bookstores, I think, are carrying it at this time.
All right, great. So what's next for you?
Oh, what's next? Boy, I am trying desperately to get my TV show back up and running, getting off the ground in some way, shape, or form. So it's in its very, very early stages of trying to make that happen. So don't want to say too much about it at the moment, you know. I want to try and make it self-power and all that kind of thing until it's, you know, something has come forward and into fruition. So that's the plan I'm working on right now.
Okay, great. So people go to letstalkparanormal.com, get the book, and thank you so much for being on the show again.
Thank you, Alejandro. Thank you for having me back. It was a great pleasure to be here talking with you today.
Oh, excuse me. All right. That was a lot of fun. Tracy is one cool chick, man. So go check out her book. It sounds very interesting. And of course, don't forget, in her hometown, her current hometown of Las Vegas, tomorrow night, you've got U.S. Air Force Blue Book Secrets Revealed. So, and actually it says Area 51 Secrets Revealed. None of those guys actually worked at Area 51, but that's okay because, oh no, it's Military UFO File Secrets Revealed. So that's more accurate. But so that's going to be a really interesting, very interesting show. So you guys got to check that out. So book your flight to Las Vegas. And then, like she said, check out letstalkparanormal.com to see Tracy's book. And to also, she did actually a cable show. It was on community television, but very well produced for many years. And you can go to her site and watch those videos. She did some radio shows. And like she said, oh, and I should mention a lot of that was in L.A. But now she's in Las Vegas, and hopefully she will get her show running again because it was really interesting. She's got some great interviews there. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me once again on UFO Think Tank Radio. As you know, I adore each and every one of you and am so ecstatic to spend this time with you. Every week, you guys rock the Casbah. Take it easy, and we'll talk to you next week. Adios, muchachos.